'Twas a dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, but to walk near its crest was so pleasant that over its terrible edge there had slipped a duke and full many a peasant. So the people said something would have to be done, but their projects did not at all tally. Some said, put a fence round the edge of the cliff. Some, an ambulance down in the valley. But the cry for the ambulance carried the day, for it spread through the neighboring city. A fence may be useful or not, it is true, but each heart became brimful of pity for those who slipped over the dangerous cliff, and the dwellers in highway and alley gave pounds or gave pence not to put up a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. For the cliff is all right if you're careful, they said, and if folks even slip and are dropping. It isn't the slipping that hurts them so much as the shock down below when they're stopping. So day after day, as these mishaps occurred, quick forth would those rescuers sally to pick up the victims who fell off the cliff with their ambulance down in the valley. Then an old sage remarked, it's a marvel to me that people pay far more attention to repairing results than to stopping the cause, when they'd much better aim at prevention. Let us stop at its source, all this mischief, cried he. Come, neighbors and friends, let us rally. If the cliff we would fence, we might almost dispense with the ambulance down in the valley. Better guide well the young than reclaim them from old. For the voice of true wisdom is calling. To rescue the fallen is good, but 'tis best to prevent other people from falling. Better close up the source of temptation and crime than deliver from dungeon or galley. Better put a strong fence round the top of the cliff than an ambulance down in the valley. The Bible does not say that marriage is superior to singleness. Paul indicates that singleness can be superior to marriage. It's simpler. You don't have to buy life insurance. You don't have to get a bigger van. You don't have to get a bigger house. You're free from a lot of things if you're single. And if you have the gift of celibate singleness, more power to you. God is for you. It's perfectly moral and legitimate not to marry. Don't let anybody socially pressure you into marriage, not even your family. Marriage is not for everyone. Some people are better off not married. It's much better not to marry than to marry the wrong person. However, since most people have the urge to merge, marriage is the usual state. If you are unmarried and you might possibly think that you'll want to marry at some point, we find some lessons from Abraham and Eliezer, hence this assignment to me this morning. To you who are older and looking at the young, I might say that if the young people want to talk with you about who they find attractive, they will bring it up. Don't hound them about it. It's none of your business unless they make it your business, so stay out of their business. You can be putting pressure on them without intending to. Socrates is purported to have said, my advice to you is to get married. If you find a good wife, you'll be happy. If not, you'll become a philosopher. Genesis 24 is the longest chapter in Genesis, longer than the creation account, longer than the flood account. I'm glad we all know the narrative because we certainly don't have time to cover it all this morning. But Abraham sends his servant to find a wife for Isaac. The servant is not named in this chapter, perhaps because we have the master-servant relationship emphasized. But a few decades before this, back in Genesis 15, we have Abraham speaking of the steward of his house, Eliezer of Damascus, as being his heir because Abraham had no son. Now, Isaac has been born. Abraham is 140 years old. Isaac has promised, or God has promised, some amazing things about the seed of Abraham, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Abraham's line is not supposed to end with Isaac, but Isaac has no wife. Isaac is only to marry one who shares his values. Abraham knows how important the selection of the right spouse is. So rather than just letting nature take its course, he's building a fence around the edge of the cliff. Abraham calls his eldest, most trusted servant of the house, who rules everything he has. I can't prove that this is Eliezer, but it very well may be. I think whoever wrote the title for this lesson sort of wanted it to be Eliezer, and I would like that too, but I just can't prove it. Half a century may have passed since Genesis 15, where Eliezer is named. So if this is Eliezer, he has some age on him and seemingly some wisdom in him. Abraham has Eliezer make a solemn vow that he won't take a wife for Isaac from among the Canaanites. The Canaanites were idolaters, and they were under the judgment of God for their idolatry and their depravity. Back in that 15th chapter of Genesis, it's already said there that the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, but God foresaw that it would get worse and worse, and that there was a price that would have to be paid for that. So in Deuteronomy 9:5, after this, we see that God is driving these inhabitants out of the land. So Abraham says to his servant, here in Genesis 24, go to my former country, to my kindred, to get a wife for Isaac. Now, those people weren't perfect either, but at least they acknowledged Jehovah, and that meant a lot. In the next generation, we learned that Laban indeed did have some idols, and Rachel stole them. So you don't find perfection anywhere. But for the right spouse, look where you have the greatest opportunity for success. Don't get her from the Canaanites. Go to my people. Well, what if she won't come back here with a man she doesn't know to marry a man she's never met? Shall I then take Isaac to her? Don't you dare, under any circumstances, take Isaac there, ever. He might stay, like Jacob almost did later. I don't want our progeny corrupted and defiled spiritually. This may be why Abraham didn't go back for this spouse himself. God called me out of that land. I'm not going back, and don't you ever take my son there. If she won't come with you here, you're released from your vow, and you will not be blameworthy. Abraham is making decisions based on the promises of God. He's doing everything he can to keep Isaac from falling off the cliff. He's looking at where things begin, knowing that everything downstream from that is going to be affected. 2 Corinthians 6:14, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. It's a mismatch. 1 Corinthians 7:39, a widow may marry only in the Lord. The precedent of Abraham is enshrined in the law of Moses, Deuteronomy 7:3, don't intermarry with the Canaanites. God will send his angel before you, he tells his servant. This is very interesting because in this entire lengthy narrative, nobody ever sees this angel, and we're not told of anything the angel did. But that doesn't mean he wasn't involved behind the scenes. It's like the last verse of the first chapter of the Hebrew letter. The angels are ministering spirits sent forth to minister to them who shall be the heirs of salvation. That's us. What do we specifically see, hear, and know that the angels do for us in any given venture of our lives? There may be angels with us in this room right now, but what do I know about that? Next to nothing. What did the angel of God do for this servant? I don't know. We don't see the angel doing anything, but he worked. There's no control experiment where the angel did not go before him to show us how things might have gone differently. But when he found Rebekah, this servant said, quote, Jehovah led me, end quote. The providence of God is real and it operates. The angels of God are real and they function on our behalf. We're asked perpetual questions about both because we know so little. The destination of the servant may have been 500 miles as the crow flies, longer with twists and turns, but Rebekah was worth the trip. This servant takes 10 camels. Camels in that time were extremely valuable, capable of carrying heavy loads through hostile desert terrains. They themselves were a sign of wealth, but he loads them up with lots and lots of choice goods to prove his case by material abundance. This is like taking 10 very expensive SUVs, full of very expensive stuff. It's impressive. In the 10th verse, we see that the servant goes to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. Not a city named Nahor, necessarily, but the city where Nahor's family lived. Nahor was Abraham's brother. Later we learned that Laban lived in the city of Haran. Haran was Abraham's other brother. So lots of people there in this city and in this area are related to Abraham in one way or another. The servant has gone to exactly the right place. Verse 11, he had his camels kneel down outside the city by a well of water at the time of the evening when women go out to draw water. If you want to catch fish, go where the fish are. If you want to find a girl, go where the girls are. Now, there are lots of places girls are. This servant does not go to a house of prostitution. He doesn't go to a strip club. He doesn't go to a bar. The odds of finding the right girl in those places are negligible. He comes to the well where all kinds of girls will be because of the universal need for water and the custom of women carrying it. I was in the Philippines one time on the outskirts of Manila in a sort of a suburb there, and I saw what turned out to be a servant woman carrying a plastic container of water. She'd gotten it out of a spigot some distance away from the house she was working in. And she was a grown woman, but she was small, and she's lugging this container along. And water is heavy, so I just took it from her and carried it up to the house where she was trying to go. And I was given to understand in no uncertain terms, that is for her to do, not for you to do. She has her role, you have your role. That's our tradition. All I could say was, my dad taught me that if you see somebody that needs help, help them. That's my tradition. The point is, apparently this kind of tradition still applies in some places. Women go to the well, women carry the water. So the servant of Abraham apparently knew that there'd be a good sampling of women here at the well in the evening. All kinds of women. That didn't change much up to the time of Jesus. Jesus, much later, met an immoral woman at a well in Sychar. But he had a profitable conversation with her. And her influence in that town caused the Lord and his disciples to spend 2 days there gathering a spiritual harvest among the Samaritans. We don't have any record that she ever did give the Lord the drink that he asked for, because the conversation quickly turned to more important things. So Abraham's servant comes to the well looking for a particular kind of girl. He goes to the right place, in the right town, at the right time, seemingly the most likely public place where she might be found, but he still may have felt like he was looking for a needle in a haystack. So he prays the first prayer in the Bible, asking for a personal favor, asking for success in a specific thing. Happy marriages are most likely to be made in the fear of God. It's interesting that external beauty is not a qualification in the servant's prayer, nor was it something Abraham made the servant swear to find. Boys in particular need to keep in mind that physical beauty is not essential. It can be a blessing, but with time it fades. It's better to have a woman with the character of Rebecca, pure, humble, hospitable, industrious, faithful, prompt. That's beauty. One day when my mother was raising me, we had a discussion about Marilyn Monroe. She was a movie star. I think everybody is aware of who she was, though she died in 1962. This was during her lifetime, so I couldn't have been very old. But my mother said, pretty is as pretty does. And somehow that stuck with me all through these years. Pretty is as pretty does. There's a lot of truth in that. Abraham's servant knows there may be all kinds of women here, so he prays, when I ask one for a drink, let the one who says, drink and I'll water your camels also, let her be the one. There's wisdom and logic behind this, because a camel can drink a lot of water. If a man drinks a quart of water, that's a lot, even for a thirsty man. But a camel that's been traveling through the desert without water for days needs to replace all the water that it's lost. And it might drink 20 gallons, and that's the most conservative estimate I have found. 10 camels means 200 gallons of water, perhaps as a minimum. And what's Rebecca working with? She comes out with a pitcher on her shoulder. Why is it on her shoulder? Because it probably has some weight to it even when it's empty. I don't think she had a thin metal bucket. I know she didn't have a plastic bucket like we might use. She's either got a stone jar or an earthenware clay vessel that's been through a kiln to make it serviceable for the purpose. It probably was narrow-necked with a round body and a handle. So she's holding onto this handle, and she's got the pitcher on her shoulder. She goes down to the well, fills her vessel. I don't know how many steps might have been down into that well or not. I just don't have that detail. She fills her vessel with water and comes back up, and the servant runs to meet her because this is go time. Everything he's done was preparatory to this moment. This is the important time. He asks for a drink. Verse 18, she says, "Drink, my Lord," and lets the pitcher down on her hand and gives him a drink. I've carried a lot of 5-gallon buckets of water from the well to the chicken house. As a boy, I preferred to have a 5-gallon bucket in each hand so I'd be balanced. If I've got just one, then I'm lopsided over here. Most of you know what that's like, because water is heavy. So how much weight can a girl take on her hand and control it to give a man a drink? I don't think it's going to be 5 gallons. Most of the pitchers we found archaeologically from these times held 2 or 3 gallons. It had to be light enough so she could get home with it full, however far home was. And she handles it in a way that indicates that it's not too big for her. 2.5 gallons of water plus the weight of the pitcher was most likely enough for a girl. Girls, in general, do not have the same upper body strength that males have. That's just only one of the differences between men and women. So she's got this maybe 2.5-gallon pitcher, and without any prompting from the servant, on her own initiative, she says, "I'll water your camels too until they have done drinking. Not just I'll give them some water, but I'm going to give them water until they stop." And verse 20, she ran again to the well. Well, camels drink the water they have lost. One source I read said that a thirsty camel can drink 53 gallons. But let's make it easy on Rebecca and just say that each camel drank 20 gallons, about 20 gallons. And that's conservative. 200 gallons with a 2.5-gallon pitcher. Full of water, the pitcher weighed maybe 25, I don't know, 30 pounds. But that is 80 trips. Down to the water source and up again. Down with empty, up with full. She hasted and emptied her pitcher into the trough and ran to the well to draw. And she drew for all his camels, and she didn't stop until they stopped. And it took a while. Even if it's only 30 seconds per round trip, that's 40 minutes. If it's a minute per round trip, that's an hour and 20 minutes. This is yeoman work. This is an industrious girl with the heart of a servant. This girl is kind, helpful, diligent, athletic, and she's also beautiful, and she's also a virgin. In Abraham's seed will all nations of the earth be blessed. That seed is going to come through Isaac, the child of promise. If Rebecca had already had sex, the child she bore might be questioned as to parentage. And that could shake confidence that Jesus is the seed of Isaac and therefore the fulfillment of the promise. Verse 21, the servant wondered at her in silence, watching her work. I think that means his jaw dropped as he watched this girl. Did he want to help her? I would. But perhaps custom and protocol prevented that. The servant is looking at a Proverbs 31 woman. In verses 16 through 20, Rebecca is the subject of 11 verbs. Something needs to be done, and she's doing it. And look how fast. And I can just see the wheels turning in the servant's brain. My master's guest would be well served by this girl. Rebecca identifies herself as Isaac's bride by her actions. And when she finished the job, the servant gave her a golden nose ring and two golden bracelets. If you like nose rings, verse 47 is your verse. Just the raw gold itself in the ring and the bracelets was worth $9,230 in our place in August 2025. That's just the raw gold. The average worker at that time and place would earn 10 shekels of silver in a whole year. There was no middle class. But when we look at these bracelets and this nose ring, if we add in the probable artistry and the cultural significance, and we add the actual purchasing power up with reference to our money at this present time, he may be giving her the equivalent of $350,000. This is quite a gift. And he asks if he can stay at her father's house. Rebecca ran home. She's got a new shot of adrenaline now. And told her story. And when her brother Laban saw the nose ring and the bracelets, ka-ching, he runs to the servant at the well. Come in, thou blessed of Jehovah. So the servant tells his story, and he asks for a decision. Tell me one way or the other so I know what to do next. And the family, in trying to process what's happening, asked for 10 days. The servant said, don't delay me. Don't delay me. You could make a whole lesson just out of this servant. Delayed obedience is disobedience. He wants to get back. So let's ask Rebecca, the family says. Wilt thou go with this man? And Rebecca says, I will go. This was a patriarchal society, but it wasn't as misogynistic as a lot of people claim. There was no coercion. Rebecca could have refused, and that would apparently have been fine. The servant could have gone back to the well for another girl. This was not a kidnapping by the servant. Laban is not making Rebecca do anything, and Abraham is not purchasing her. So it's not as chauvinistic as some modern scholars paint it. Rebecca decides, and she goes heading for the ultimate blind date. She takes with her her nurse, probably Deborah, and some other servant girls. And it's a long trip back. You know how I know that? There's at least four girls on this trip. You can't drive like you did before. You know that's true. Statistically speaking, one of these four girls has a bladder the size of a walnut. So they have to stop frequently. I knew one man who bought a motorhome just so. It had a bathroom in it. He wouldn't have to stop all the time when he was traveling with his family. It may take him more than a month to get back to Abraham, but this also, I think, was advantageous. This all gives the servant an opportunity to get to know Rebecca pretty well. Maybe he drove his camel up beside her camel as they were riding along. Or maybe he talked with her beside the campfire at night after supper. He learns about her hopes, her dreams, her ambitions. He learns to know her. And at any given point, possibly, there could have been a deal killer come into the arrangements. Don't think that because you're engaged, you have to go through with it. Better a little embarrassment now than a lot of regret and agony later. Probably this servant, if need had been, could have taken her back home and started over again. I advocate a lot of conversation before we marry. Discuss all subjects and let this person know what your non-negotiables are. You need to have agreement on some major issues, and you need to actually like the person as well as love them. Loving somebody is not nearly enough reason to get married. What do you talk about? Well, God, Jesus, the Bible, the church, look well to where they stand on these issues. There might be some enormous differences that could be problems after marriage. I stopped dating girls because we didn't see eye to eye on these things. Children, how many do you want? How will we raise them? Public school, homeschool, private school, all this needs to be discussed. Will the wife work outside the home after children are born? That's a big issue. Money, another big issue, one of the biggest stressors in marriage. Who's going to manage the money? How will you invest if you do? 101 questions to discuss right there. You need to spend countless hours talking with each other and listening to each other. Family. How he or she interacts with your mother, your father, your siblings. That reveals a lot. Invite her over for dinner with your family. If she helps out, that's a good sign. If she doesn't help your mother, that gives me pause. Take her to the mall. Does she lose her mind? Does she want to carry half of it home? Some people feel better the more they spend. These are important issues. Finally, the servant escorts Rebecca to her groom. She and Isaac lock eyes through her veil and stroll off into the sunset of their wedding night. The first time the verb love is used is in chapter 22, verse 1. Abraham loved Isaac. This is the second time it's used. Isaac loved Rebecca. And who wouldn't love her? What a girl. Marriage is a providential gift from God. There is the intersection of God's providence and man's decision making. Abraham was confident of this. Jehovah will send his angel before you. Just as God brought Eve to Adam, he brought Rebecca to Isaac, and will bring the church to Jesus, our group. God is the master of marriage. I believe he guides us into marriage if we do it according to his principles. Marriage is sacred, and it's not just between a man and a woman. It is profoundly the work of God. Trust and obey God even through difficulties. If you're single and you don't want to live a celibate life, and that's most people, get to the place where you can meet a potential spouse, and that's the church, and you're already there. The church is the place where you're most likely to find singles with a spiritual interest. I know a farmer from North Missouri who went out to Las Vegas and married a showgirl. She played him like a violin. His married life was a roller coaster for years until finally she left and took him for all he was worth. Go to church. Go to church meetings. Meet and talk with lots of people. Hang out with people as a group. Develop friendships with people of both genders. We have such a wonderful group of young people right now. They like to be together as a group, which I love to see. To me, dating or courtship is based on friendship. And the better you are at developing good friendships, the better shot you have at success in dating relationships. The Bible has nothing specific to say about dating per se. Bible couples didn't date as we often do today. Dating is a cultural thing, and it's not practiced in some parts of the world even now. So pray about this, because God is the master of marriage. But man has to do his part, be at the right places at the right times. How do you choose? When you meet somebody you'd like to know better, spiritual consideration should be your utmost priority. Marry a Christian, and by that I mean a Christian by the biblical definition. Marry a committed Christian, someone who's going to lift you up and not pull you down. Look for someone who shares the same spiritual goals. It looks like Abraham's nephew Lot became unequally yoked, and he and his family paid a heavy price. One young man told me years ago, "I'm looking for a Wednesday night girl." What did he mean? He meant, I'm not even going to select just from the girls on Sunday morning. I'm going to look at the ones that come to church on Wednesday night. And he did marry one of them. And Christ and his church were a priority in that home. And all of their children now have married in the Lord and are faithful to him. Who you marry impacts future generations. There's no biblical basis for the idea of a soulmate. When you date someone, they're always putting their best foot forward. They want to impress you. Sometimes they will even mirror you to impress you. They want you to think the best of them. That's natural. So watch how they treat people that they have nothing to gain from. How do they treat the most unpopular person in your circle? How do they respond when they get upset? How do they react to the grocery store clerk? Or the waiter or waitress who serves them? How do they treat their mother? How do they treat their grandmother? They'll put their best foot forward while dating you. But after marriage, in a year or two, the way they treat others will be the way they treat you. Don't think they're going to change just because you're there. Let them change first before you attach your heart. Both they and you have your own problems with sin. Something in both of you needs working on. And marriage is a refiner of the soul. When you get under a roof with a spouse, they may not have the patience that you thought they did. But is the foundation there? The foundation that will help you both move forward in a healthy way. I've had girls tell me that some of the boys in the world treat me better than some of the boys in the church. And I don't doubt that for a moment. Shame on some of the boys in the church. I'm not suggesting that you marry somebody just because they're in the church. Don't marry a spiritual Canaanite even if they are ostensibly in the church. Marry among the people of God who have a heart for God. A girl may be the cutest little thing on 2 feet, and she may be whip smart, but how is her heart? How's her faith? How's her orientation toward God? This is so important that if you get it right, you can conquer about anything else. See that person in lots of different situations and look for wonderful character qualities. Diligence, kindness, hospitality. Being together gives you a chance to grow. Iron sharpens iron. It helps you learn to communicate better with the opposite sex. Men and women are not alike. Real communication is a learned art. Dating is an opportunity to learn it. Be yourself. Have fun. Everybody needs to play. Sometimes even animals play. Rebecca has revered her future spouse by remaining a virgin. Jesus lived as a virgin his entire earthly life. Body and soul are intertwined with each other. If you separate them, you're dead. That's how intertwined they are. What you do with your body impacts your soul, and you can scar your soul. The sexual revolution has damaged a lot of people. God's plan is monogamous marriage. That hasn't changed just because it's 2025. Isaac and Rebecca's was not a perfect marriage, but they established a platform of health to walk forward in a beautiful way. You can decide right now to take a healthy step forward closer to Jesus. When you love your wife as Christ loved the church, it makes her closer to what God wants her to be. Don't wait for her to be more lovable. Your love is what helps transform her. God's rule is that sex is expressed in the security of marriage and not before. Sex is an expression of love, not a proof of it. Some people think God's unfair, that he made us sexual beings and then tells us don't. And they'll point out that when you love somebody and get close to them, it's hard to control yourself. We've always known that. That's why Paul tells Timothy, flee youthful lusts. Sex is like a fire. The same fire that warms a house can burn it right down. You don't take a burning log out of the fireplace and build a fire on your living room rug. A fire burning outside the limits of the fireplace destroys and kills. The right place for sex to burn is in the fireplace of marriage. There it is good and gives warmth to your relationship. When running water is guided by a faucet, it quenches thirst. Without boundaries, running water floods and destroys. Wild horses look beautiful, but they fight when approached. Only when harnessed and trained can they bring the power to do you good. Like untamed horses, when sex is used without God's guidance, it kicks. God is not unfair. He is by nature a fulfiller, not a restrictor. When he limits our sexual activity to marriage, he's not trying to steal our fun. He has logical, loving reasons, whether we understand them all or not. The devil wants us to believe that he is the sex expert, that if we get too close to God or we get too holy, we're going to miss something. Satan always does this. Eve, God is holding out on you. Eat that forbidden fruit and you'll be like God. But it's a lie that we'll miss something if we do it God's way. The truth is we'll miss something if we don't. God is for you. He wants your greatest pleasure and fulfillment. God didn't need to give us taste buds, for example. We could do without taste buds. God could have made filling your stomach like filling your car, a very mundane experience. He could have put a little gauge on your wrist to tell you when you need to eat, another gauge to tell you whether it's food or poison. The main reason for taste buds is pleasure. He giveth us richly all things to enjoy. Well, if God wants me to enjoy what I eat, then I ought to be able to eat any amount at any time, right? No, that's not logical. If I know my stomach holds a certain amount and I eat a whole lot more than that, that's just not very smart. It's best that I limit my enjoyment. Likewise, we can't logically reason that because God has given us sexuality, that any amount is good at any time and under any circumstances. Sex before marriage tends to strain love rather than strengthening it. Waiting together helps you two to seal the bond between you. Now, Scripture does not explicitly answer how far is too far, such as holding hands is okay, but kissing is wrong. It doesn't say that. But God has designed a natural physical progression which culminates in sexual intercourse. And the more you do in that progression, the more you're going to want to do. Once you start the progression, it's difficult to stop, and stopping results in frustration. It's like a drug in that way. After a while, the thing that once thrilled and satisfied doesn't do so anymore, and we then get more physically involved. There's a law of diminishing returns. So here's a guideline. If you feel comfortable telling adult Christians about what you're doing sexually, then you're probably okay. Sexual control is not easy, but God promises that we can do it if we choose to. You have many examples of people who have already done it until marriage. There won't be any temptation too strong if we trust God. 1 Corinthians 10:13, Philippians 4:13. Stay away from sexually tempting situations. Avoid situations that have been tempting to you in the past. Thank your date for helping you wait. Decide what your standard is before you're in the place of temptation. It's easier to break no standard than some standard. So don't just slide, decide. The backseat of a car is no place to decide how far you should go. And girls, if your word no is not enough, he doesn't love you. Anyone who will push you in this area now will push you in other areas later. I've seen situations where the guy said, well, if you love me, you'll let me. And before long, he was saying, if you love me, you'll get an abortion. That's the way it works. There are good reasons to wait, but why should you even have to explain why? It's your body. It's your life. Why can't he respect you for who you are and what you are and what you say? Reserve your body for your mate when they officially are your mate. Why should you wait? God said to. He thought it all up. He knows what works best. Flee fornication. Like every other command, it's to protect you from bad things and provide you with good things. He wants you to have the best relationship with your husband or wife. Proverbs 6:27-29. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? Sex is a fire, and you can't play with it and not be burned. Proverbs 6:32. The one who commits adultery lacks sense. Moral impurity destroys us emotionally. So discuss it together and pray about it. Keep your relationship centered on God. See yourself as a brother and sister in Christ. Flee fornication. Joseph didn't stick around and try to talk Potiphar's wife out of it. He just got out of the situation. The old timers used to say, you flee, you fight fornication with your hat, grab it and run. But Joseph didn't even grab his hat. He left his garment in her hands. Sometimes in the Bible, we're told, resist the devil and he will flee from you. But when the issue is fornication, we flee because the temptation is that intense. Listen to me. Those who engage in premarital sex are the ones most likely to engage in extramarital sex later. If you get used to cheating, it's a hard habit to break. In marriage, your sexual expressions can be limited by somebody working out of town or by illness or by the later stages of pregnancy. So show your potential spouse now that you have the discipline to wait, and that may help them trust you later on. Self-control is a fruit of the Holy Spirit, Galatians 5:23. And by the way, sexual intercourse causes babies. And in part two, after lunch, we'll talk about raising those babies. But just now, in closing, notice this. God's servant, who may have been Eliezer, stayed on task. He was faithful to his mission, and he finished his job. I won't eat until I say why I'm here. Send me away. Don't delay me. He was not distracted by food or ease. That's probably why Abraham sent him in the first place. Rebekah is like a female Abraham. She responds in faith. She leaves her home and people. God worked out his will through this one family to fulfill the promises that we all enjoy now. Like the church, Rebekah believed the message of the Son through his servant. She left all to follow the Son. She was led of God to the Son. So I hope that if you're outside of Christ today, you will allow us this morning to be servants of God to help you become a child of God. If we can assist you in any way, come to the front as we stand together. We're going to sing one more song.